Well, you probably have heard, and if you didn't, you're going to hear now, in the second and third century, that is 100 to 200 years after Christianity began, there were many Christians who were given a choice, and that choice was to bow either literally or figuratively to the Roman Empire or the Roman Emperor himself, or be jailed and face confiscation of your property or even be sentenced to death. Some buckled. Some recanted their faith. Others refused to cave or to pinch incense on the altar devoted to the Caesar. That scenario there seems barbaric and unlikely today. We, American Christians, have become so fixated with our freedoms and our constitutional rights in the last number of years that we probably have thought, well, this will never happen. And yet, in this last year, we have seen many of those freedoms under attack, many of those freedoms being violated and threatened altogether. So this idea of the United States becoming a godless country with atheistic government has once been unthinkable, and yet now we're kind of staring that in the face, and it's very disturbing. But we don't have to bow to a government leader and submit to all his commands in order to bow to the world. Every time compromise is made of your conscience in order to participate in any worldly behavior, and when I say worldly, I don't mean just of the world at all, but worldly in the sense of contradictory to Christianity, be it a movie, a TV show, a video game, a website, profanity, bad company, indifference to sin, we are bowing to the God of this world. Anytime that we compromise our faith in any way in order to gratify our personal lusts and our desires, we are bowing to the God of this world. And anytime we choose to conform to worldly people rather than or at the expense of conforming to Christ, we are bowing to the God of this world. Well, we don't always see it that way. Bowing and pinching incense to the emperor is a violation of one's covenant with God, but then someone's going to say, well, I would never do that. And yet some Christians might tip their hat to Satan nonetheless and think nothing of the contradiction. We know that Christ paid the price that Christ paid for our forgiveness and our grace, but we need to be equally aware of the price that it's going to cost us in our association with him. Jesus himself said that it's going to take everything that we have, and possibly more than some of us are willing to give, if indeed we are not fully committed to him. None of this began in the second or third century with the Christians before the emperor. Daniel chapter 3, 600 years before Jesus, we see Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego providing a powerful example of what it costs individual believers to associate with God as opposed to being swept up with the rest of the world. We should note here that while this story is often viewed as just a story, it is a historical account and has all the markings of a real event rather than just a story. So this is not a history lesson. This lesson this morning, oops, I don't want to go that far, is not a history lesson. What we're really asking is, what is your faith in Jesus Christ worth to you? And even more so, what are you willing to sacrifice to keep your faith and to honor Christ and to follow through with your commitment to him? Is it going to be worth the sacrifice of your time? Is it going to be worth the sacrifice of your money or of your friends or of your loved ones or even your life? And then you consider what Jesus said here in Luke 14:26, that basically, if I could paraphrase, that if you put anyone or anything else ahead of me, you cannot be my disciple. That doesn't mean that people won't call themselves his disciple after all. What it means, though, is that we are not following through with what it means to be his disciple, and in the end, we will not be with him. I'm seeing a problem here. This is not my slideshow. That's why this is not working right. I don't think I got the right slideshow here transferred over. The name is this same title here. This is Notice self-disclosure, I had a lot of trouble with my laptop this week, and in doing so, I had to transfer all kinds of files and everything else. I'm not sure that you're going to see all the pictures that I had spent so much time putting together for this slideshow. So there's supposed to be a picture right here. Anyway, that's frustrating. Let's just go on. We're introduced to Daniel and his friends as they're being brought from Babylon, or to Babylon from Judea. So Daniel and his friends, which are later called Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, that's not their original names, that's not their Hebrew names, but that's what we know them as. They are brought from Judea into Babylon, again, around 600 BC. You can see that in verse 6 of chapter 1. Now among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and the commanders of the officials assigned them new names, and there are the names that he gave them. We just mentioned. So while Daniel is the most famous among them, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, they do share in his ordeals. And we do see that Daniel does make a request of the commander here to have water and vegetables instead of the king's choice food, which would have been fatty and unhealthy and, most importantly, unclean for a Jew to eat, because it would have been desecrated with all kinds of unclean animals, which would have been a violation of Daniel's and his friend's conscience. And after 10 days, we see there that in verse 11 through 13 of chapter 1, that there is a noticeable difference. He says, "Let our appearance be observed in the presence of the king." In verse 15, at the end of 10 days, their appearance was better, and they were fatter, which really means healthier, okay, than all the youths who have been eating the king's choice food here. So there, we see that visible difference there. I want you to think about that in a parallel here, that if we eat the world's food, and I'm not talking about actual food now, I'm talking about partaking of the world, then what are we going to look like? We're going to look like the rest of the world. One thing about Christians that should be notably different is that because of what they eat, meaning the Word of God, they should turn out differently. They should look differently. So there is a parallel in thought here. So Daniel, of course, was the most celebrated of his friends, but his friends were considered, along with Daniel, the best of the best. As for these four youths, chapter 1, verse 17, "As for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams." And then they were presented before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king talked with them, and none of them was found like these four young men. So they entered into the king's personal service. That's a high accolade. That's a very important thing. We do know that Nebuchadnezzar does have a disturbing dream. None of the wise men there in chapter 2 of Daniel can know this dream. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar does something really important. He says, "First of all, tell me what I dreamt, and then you can tell me the interpretation." And they said, "Well, if you tell us the dream, then we'll tell you the interpretation." And he says, "No, if I tell you the dream, you'll make up your own interpretation. I need you to tell me the dream." And so you think about that. I mean, it's one thing to assign a personal interpretation to a dream. It's another thing to know the dream beforehand. And so in the course of all that, the wise men and magicians are all sentenced to death, and that edict that Nebuchadnezzar makes lumps Daniel and his friends in with all these godless advisors and seers and magicians. And by the way, when we say magicians, we don't mean magicians in the form of street magicians that we see today. We're talking about people who dabbled in the arts of astrology and magic and so on. Really what we call the occult today. Chapter 2 and verse 17 and 18, we see there that Daniel and his friends, they go to the king, they entreat the king there and ask that these men not be destroyed. And then Daniel, of course, not only can tell Nebuchadnezzar what he dreamed, but he gives him the proper interpretation to that dream. And so in verse 46, you see that Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face. I'm in chapter 2, verse 46. He fell on his face and paid homage to Daniel, gave orders to present to him an offering and a fragrant incense. The king answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you've been able to reveal this mystery." And he promotes Daniel and his friends to positions of high authority. So that's where we find Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego when we come across them in chapter 3 here. Okay? So the focus of chapter 3 is really on those three men rather than Daniel. Many have speculated, well, where's Daniel? Was he hiding? Was he one of those that bowed? We know Daniel's character, that he didn't bow. He wasn't hiding. Most likely he was off in a foreign country taking care of business for the king. That makes the most sense given his position. Nebuchadnezzar constructed a very large and tall statue, possibly in honor of Marduk, which was the god of the Babylonians, the chief god of Babylon. Some of that height may have been in the pedestal, but it's said to be 60 cubits. A cubit is a foot and a half. 60 times a foot and a half is 90 feet. So that's a pretty tall structure, to say the least. It's 9 stories tall. It would be visible from a great distance. And Nebuchadnezzar assembled all of his military and civil leaders, provincial representatives, his treasurers, his judges, all those who were important to his administration. And these were all to recognize that Nebuchadnezzar was a sovereign king and that his word was law and that he was literally, in that time, the most powerful man in the world. It's really hard for us to wrap our mind around that kind of power and authority. We're not talking about a man who is just powerful in his own country. We're talking about a man who is the most powerful in his country, and his country wraps around most of the known or civilized world at that time. And so what he says is law. He doesn't have to go through a bunch of people and get legislative acts and votes and, consent. He just simply speaks a command, and it is law. So again, it's hard for us to recognize that kind of authority. So Nebuchadnezzar also assembled a number of musicians, and at the sound of the music, all of these were commanded to bow down and pay homage to this idol. This was not uncustomary for heathens to bow to their patron gods. Those who believed in that god would pay honor to it anyway and bow down and be spared from divine punishment as they saw it. Those who didn't believe in this god would still bow down to be spared from the wrath of the king who told them to bow down, if you follow me. In other words, they know it's a fake god. They know it's not real. They know that it's not their god, but they want to bow down anyway because they don't want to be destroyed by the king. In chapter 3, verse 6 and 7, if you're still with me there, Nebuchadnezzar says, "Whoever does not fall down and worship shall be immediately cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire." And then at that time, when all the people heard the sound of all the musical instruments there, they all bowed down and worshiped the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Except for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They refused to do this. And they were pointed out that they refused to do this. And Nebuchadnezzar is not quiet about his response to that. Chapter 3, verse 13, this starts where Aaron had read for us. Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these three men were brought before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar says, in so many words, "Perhaps you didn't understand the instructions," right? That the music's going to play, you bow down, and if you do so, it's all going to be all right. But if you don't, then there's a big furnace over here that you're going to be thrown into. And I'm not joking here, okay? It's kind of what he's saying, if I could just condense his response to them. And so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they reply that we don't really need to give you answer concerning this. We already know what God that we serve. We already know what God that we follow. We have always served a greater king than you, is really what they're saying. Even though you are the greatest king on the world, we serve a God that is above this world. And we're not about to stop that. And Nebuchadnezzar says in so many words, in fact, he says literally in those words, "What God can deliver you," in verse 15, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego say, in essence, our God can. But even if he doesn't, then we're not going to force his hand. He's still worth worshiping. He's still worth serving. He's still worthy of our allegiance just because of who he is. I mean, just think about that. You're standing up to the most powerful man in the world. There's a blazing fire sitting over here off to the side that will be your end if you refuse to do what this king says. And they stand up for their faith in God. Now Nebuchadnezzar has no choice, of course, if he's going to protect the strength of his authority, and he tells those people that are in charge of it to fire up the furnace 7 times hotter. Keep in mind that he's very angry. He wants to make an example of these men. If you look at verse 19 in chapter 3, he's filled with wrath. His facial expression was altered toward these men. I mean, here is a man just absolutely overtaken with rage. And he doesn't order Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to be clothed in ceremonial sacrificial gowns or to be stripped bare, as you would expect in other circumstances. He has them cast into this furnace fully clothed, and yet the fire is so intensely hot that those who cast them into the fire are themselves immediately killed by the heat of the flame. And then, in chapter 3 and verse 24, Nebuchadnezzar is looking into the furnace, and it says the king was astounded and stood up in haste. And he said to his high officials, "Was it not 3 men that we cast into the midst of the fire?" And they replied, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see 4 men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." And then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace of blazing fire and said, "Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, and come here." And then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire. And everyone gathers around them in verse 27 and saw that the fire had had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was the hair of their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor did they even have the smell of fire upon them. Just think about what's happening here. These men stood up to the king. They're thrown into the fiery furnace. Nebuchadnezzar's own men are killed in the process by the fire that was intended for these 3 men. And these 3 men are unharmed, not just unharmed, but untouched by the fire itself. Whereas Nebuchadnezzar's own men, remember, who themselves had bowed down to this image, they themselves are killed. Nebuchadnezzar's God couldn't stop Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from worshiping it, couldn't stop them from their resistance there, I should say. But this false god also couldn't stop these other men who cast them into the fire from being killed. The only one that's saving anyone here is the God of heaven. And what's interesting here, and keep in mind, this probably took place years, even decades later than chapter 1. So these are not young men anymore, most likely. And most likely, this is after the destruction of Jerusalem, which took place in 586, 587 BC. So a number of years later, 15, 20 years possibly has transpired. So in Judea, Jerusalem has been destroyed. The temple lays in ruins. The altar fires have been extinguished. The priests have been killed or hauled into captivity. There's no priestly intercession. There's no sacrifices being offered to God. Jewish national worship was nearly dead, almost extinct. But the God that the Jews worship was not dead, was not weakened, and was not any less powerful than he was before. And that's the message there, is that God is still very much alive. And those who put their trust in this God, they themselves will be protected to the extent that God wants them to be by this same God. This is no trick. This is no mistake. This is no simple story. So Nebuchadnezzar, who once sought to destroy Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, now honors them and praises them. Okay, I'm sorry that the slideshow is out of order here. What you're seeing is kind of my raw slideshow before I go dress it up and put pictures in. So that's why it's kind of wonky, okay? I'm not sure that's a word, but it is now. So anyway, that's what's happened here. So he praises these men for what they have done for the God that they serve. And in fact, even goes so far as to say in verse 29, anyone who says anything offensive to their God shall be torn limb from limb, their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. Not even Nebuchadnezzar's God can do that. Remember, his word is law. And so when he speaks something, he means it. So what are we seeing here? As far as practical lessons, we see that Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, they showed extraordinary courage, moral excellence by refusing to bow when the music played. In other words, in refusing to conform to the God and the people of the world. There's a powerful example then of what it means to stand up for the Lord. And I know what someone might be saying here is, it's like, well, it's no big deal. The king's God was fake anyway. You know, we all know it's just a pretend God. So if you bow down to a pretend God, no harm done, right? That is just not true. And there's a huge mistake in that kind of reasoning. I would cite Matthew 4, verse 8 through 10, as we're doing here. In response to that, we have Jesus in his temptation in the wilderness, and the devil has confronted him. The devil takes him to a high mountain, shows him all the kingdoms of the world, promises to give them to Jesus if he would just bow down and worship the devil. Now, Jesus knows the devil doesn't have that kind of power. But Jesus knows that the devil is a false god. But in bowing down to him, he would have violated his own allegiance to his Father. And that's why he responds, "You shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only," is the key word, only. He says, worship him only. Don't worship him as well. Don't worship him alongside. And don't worship him as long as it doesn't offend someone else, but worship him only. And that only exclusion there forbids anyone from bowing down to any other god, whether that worship is real or pretend, whether that god is real or pretend. It prevents anyone from bowing down to any god and claiming to be a god follower. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego did not just merely practice religion. They didn't just go to church, if you will. They didn't just call themselves servants of God. They lived for their God. They loved their God. And they were willing, even if necessary, to die for their God, regardless if he intervened and spared them or whether he did not. Moral excellence is really what we're talking about here. Moral excellence, drawn from 2 Peter 1, verse 5. Add to your faith or supply your faith with moral excellence. It literally means the courage to do what is right, simply because it is right, no matter what the consequences. So moral excellence doesn't mean that we sit around and calculate the cost of serving Christ in the moment when we're faced with a decision. Moral excellence is having already made up your mind to serve Christ so that when that time of decision comes, the decision has already been made. You don't have to sit there and wring your hands and go, what am I going to do? Who am I going to follow? Which direction am I going to go? You already know that. The cost is already known. The decision is already made. The sacrifice is already committed. Your life has already been surrendered. And if you think about any time that anyone is baptized, including most of us, when we were baptized, we committed to that at that time. We committed to that. And that's how it has to be, and that's how it has to stay. One's allegiance to Christ must be determined before he is asked to bow when the music plays, so to speak, or before the world bids your allegiance to it. We need to know where we stand before we go out into the world. Someone says, well, I'll never be put in that situation. Fact is, you already are. Satan is asking you to bow every day. And some people do. some Christians do. Those who have not yet sanctified Christ as Lord in their heart, a phrase out of 1 Peter 3:15, they see no harm in doing that. Even if they don't believe in the God of this world, they know it's fake, or they know it's not real, they know it's just a false worship, it's easier to go along with the masses than to be called out, singled out, pointed out like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were. You know what was happening, right? Everyone's bowing down, but kind of keeping an eye up to see who isn't bowing down. And then when it's all Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego not bowing down, they go and rat them out. Because that's what people do in the world. They're a bunch of snitches. And they rat people out who don't conform. And that's really sad to say that, but that's what you're seeing. In fact, you're seeing in our society today, turning everyone into a bunch of snitches. Rat people out who don't conform to our policies, to our worldviews, to our belief system, you know, to our propaganda. And that's really a frightening thing to consider, but here we are. Christians whose faith is deliberately weak and malnourished and uneducated, they offer Satan little or no resistance. When he says bow, they bow. When he says blend in, they blend in. When he says take the path of least resistance, they listen, they obey, they follow. Romans chapter 14, verse 7 and 8, Paul says, for not one of us lives for himself, not one of us dies for himself. For if we live, we live for the Lord, or if we die, we die for the Lord. Therefore, whether we live or die, we are the Lord's. There's no guarantee that you're going to not suffer. There's no guarantee that you'll even live through it. But you are the Lord's either way, if indeed you belong to him. So whether in life or death, whether in prosperity or in difficult times, whether in health or in sickness, we live and we die for Christ. Now that sounds ominous, doesn't it? Because we all thought that we're coming to a nice quiet church service and we're sitting on pews and listen to a nice sermon and sing some songs and we all go home and, you know, that's all there is to it. And here you have a preacher telling you, out of God's word, by the way, that your life is on the line right now because of your allegiance to Christ and your association with him. It's been my observation that many Christians claim to be willing to die for the Lord. I hear that, right? And we even sing songs about that. But they're not always willing to live for the Lord. And the fact is, and it's true, that if you're not willing to live for the Lord, then you're really not willing or prepared to die for him. Doesn't matter what you say. So we're seeing this happening. We're seeing it happening in other countries first. In communist-controlled, Muslim-controlled countries, we're seeing Christians losing their lives because of their faith, because of their refusal to bow to the gods that those countries put up. We haven't seen it here so much, but it is happening, and I want us to be prepared. More importantly, God wants us to be prepared. In Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10 through 14, we're told to stand firm. There's another number of things that stand firm means. It means, first of all, hold your ground or hold your post. Think of a military scenario here where a soldier is given a gun, right, and told to hold your post and guard your territory here. Stand your ground. Stand firm in your post. Don't buckle. Don't fold. Don't bend. Don't recant your faith. To recant is to go back on what you said. Don't look around and see what everyone else is doing, because I think there's a lot of that going on right now. You know, someone's asked a direct question, and then it's like, well, what is everyone else doing first, you know? And looking around to see what are the, you know, my friends or family doing, and then kind of going along with the predominant decision of the friends and family. And don't merely confess Christ as Lord, but confess him as your Lord. Because those are two different things. To confess Christ as Lord is what everyone will do in the end. But to confess Christ as your Lord is only what you can do right now. You can choose to do that. And whether God spares your physical life or whether he doesn't, he most certainly will save your soul if indeed you refuse to bow when the music plays. No one said that this was easy or would be easy, but Christ does say that it is doable and necessary. I want to make a final observation that Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, they stood together as one man. Have you noticed that? They stood together as one. They could count on the faithfulness of their fellow believer so confidently that they could speak as one. So they don't say, "I will not bow down to your image." They say, "We will not bow down to your image. We will worship God and God alone." They're so confident of where their fellow believer stands that they can speak that way. Will we be counted upon? Can people count on us? Can people count on you? Can you count on me so that when we are finally faced with the adversary, and he asks the question, "Will you bow down to the false god of the world?" we can say confidently, "We will not." Will you choose water and vegetables over the gluttonous food of the world? Again, I'm not talking about real food. I'm talking about spiritual things versus godless things. Will you listen to Christ, who has overcome the world? Or will you listen to the God of this world? Will you allow the rage and anger of Satan, like the rage and anger of Nebuchadnezzar, intimidate you and compel you to change your mind? Will you practice moral excellence, or will you instead allow your conscience and your faith to be compromised? I read somewhere recently, I think it was a posting on social media, someone said, "When you tell a lie, all your truths come into question." Think about that. When you tell one lie, everything you believe is true or say is true comes into question. So if you're going to be confronted with someone that puts your faith on the line and makes you choose one thing or another, and you buckle at that moment, you compromise your faith, that's a lie. And it calls all your belief system into question. Now, what is true to you? Are you going to live by love and wisdom, which is how we're told to live as Christians? Or are you going to just live by fear and safety, which is what the world is teaching us right now in no uncertain terms? Live by fear and live by safety. Or are you going to stand for the Lord like these three men did? Like Daniel did himself? Or are you going to bow to the world? Do you know that three times Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's lives were rescued by God? The first time was during the Babylonian invasion. Because in that invasion, a lot of Jews didn't survive. They were killed outright. Secondly, the king's edict concerning the dream and his edict to kill all the seers and the counselors and the wise men, they were spared that as well. Thirdly, from the blazing fire. Three times God had spared these men's lives because they had already made a decision to serve God himself. And when people refuse to do that, then nothing else works. Nothing else saves, and nothing else matters. I know a lot of people today are banking on good intentions, and I feel right in my heart, and God knows my heart, and other kind of, you know, fluffy statements that really don't mean anything. But good intentions are no substitute for obedience. They never have been. So really, it comes down to this right here, what you're seeing on the screen. What is your decision? You can't wait until you're presented with the decision to make the decision. The decision has to be made ahead of time. And that's a lot of what attitude is, honestly, is making up your mind ahead of time as to how you're going to live your life. If that's true, generally speaking, it's also true in the spiritual realm. having the mindset of how I'm going to respond to any given situation, I already know which direction I'm going to go before the decision even presents itself. That's what Daniel did. That's what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. And that's what we are called to do as well. So who has your heart? Would be a good way of looking at that. Who has your highest allegiance? The world is not getting friendlier and more accepting of the Christian faith. Instead, I see it coming after us with an awful vengeance, because it has wanted to destroy us for a long time, but didn't have the means or the opportunity, and now it does, and it is going to take full advantage of that. So, what are you going to do about that? There's options here, of course. You can just fold and buckle, like I said, recant your faith, or just, you know, play along when you think so, think no one's looking, or because you think it doesn't matter. You can do all that. Or you can just simply stand for what is right and stand for what is true and be right with the Lord and stand there for the Lord no matter what. Guess which ones are going to be with him in the hereafter? It will be that latter group. Which group do you want to be in? You're making that decision today. If there's anyone here that needs to make that decision itself,